So as we turn to the opening remarks, if you take a look at the, this isn't going to look so well on the tape, but if you look at the mezuzah on the door over there, right? See? Right? There's a mezuzah on Nancy's side of the door. You can't see it anymore, Nancy. You can't see it anymore. Because the reason I say anymore is because when I came here as rabbi, the mezuzah was on the other side of the door. Right? So we quietly moved it from one side to the other. So why do we move it from one side to the other? So the reason is that in Hilchos mezuzah, you put a mezuzah from the hallway into the door. That's the most important, right? It's a mezuzah going into a room. Since this room is more chashiv than the hallway, right? So therefore, I thought it was proper to put the mezuzah from that room coming into here. So okay, that's good. But however, Rabbi Kaplan put up the mezuzah going from here into there, right? So what was his reasoning? So before I asked to make that change, I called him up and said, Rabbi Kaplan, what's the story with the mezuzah from the dining room to the hallway? To which he responded, well, when we originally built the building, the original intention, I think, was to use this door, like, daily, he claimed. He claimed that the plan was that this would be the door that we would use for the daily minyan. So that everybody would come in, so they'd file in through that door, come through this room, and then walk into there. Therefore, the majority of the traffic would be, this was almost be a hallway, to go in that direction. So therefore, the mezuzah was put from this room going into that room, as well as from that room going into this room. Don't worry, you came to the right chair. Don't worry, this is all a matter of introduction. Okay, so why am I talking about Hilchos Mezuzah before we get into as an introduction to Hilchos of brain death? So there's two important things I want to point out from that. Number one is that it's very interesting that Hilchos Mezuzah, I happen to be a big fan of Hilchos Mezuzah, we'll talk about that another time. But Hilchos Mezuzah I find very interesting because there's no chumras in Hilchos Mezuzah. There are a few chumras, there are a few stringencies in Hilchos Mezuzah, in that there might be a room that doesn't really need and maybe you'll put on anyways. Okay, there's a chumra there. But in these kinds of questions, when you have one room next to another room, and you either have to figure out which direction to put the mezuzah in, from here to there, from there to here, right? So you can't do what? You can't be chumra, you can't put it on both doors. It's a little bit of a question why not. But whatever, the practice is, I don't think anybody here has ever seen a mezuzah on both directions, going in and out of a room, right? Has anybody ever seen that before? Right? So we don't. So why is it? So why not? So whatever, we don't do that. So what is so exciting then about Hilchos Mezuzah, right? In that you have to actually pass it. You actually have to come to a conclusion. Rather than just say, we're going to push it off and push it off, whatever, we'll be chatten, we'll be machmir, we'll do this, we'll do that. You actually have to decide that question one way or the other. You can't really straddle the fence. You can't really straddle the fence at all. So that's number one of the mezuzah mashal. The second part of the mezuzah mashal is that... that the halacha was always the same. The halacha in terms of which side of a door does a mezuzah go on, right? It always was whichever room is more chashiv, is more important, right? So you have a mezuzah that goes into that room. Right, so the halacha is the same, right? The line, if you look up in Shulchan Aruch, that's the law that you're going to see. So why did it change, right? Why did it change from being on one side of the door to being on the other side of the door? Because as we got to know the shul better, as we got to understand the layout more, and as we got to understand how people walk from one room to another within the shul, right? So we realized that really this room is a little bit more chashuv and more important than that room, right? So the halacha stays the same. The halacha was always the same. The halacha of Hilchos Mezuzah, right, in Shulchan Aruch has been the same for a couple thousand years, right? What changed? Our perception and our understanding about the way the building worked. So it's going to be the same thing as we analyze, the halachos of how to analyze the time of death, right? The halachos are always the same, we think. I mean, the halachas are always the same, we just don't quite understand what they are necessarily. But the halachas are always the same, right? It's a question, as we get to understand the human body a little bit better, and as we get to understand different circumstances and how things could work, and perhaps their new inventions, right? So our understanding of how to apply the halacha may change over time. And that's a very important distinction to understand with anything that you learn, right? The halacha is the same, the circumstances might be different. And the Rosh Hashanah used to drill that into us over and over and over again, which was good that he did. Okay, so just as a way of a further introduction, that was introduction 1A. Introduction 1B goes as follows. A couple of months ago, I guess it was Thanksgiving weekend, so that's already 3-4 months ago, so I received an invitation in the mail to go to the Aguda convention. It always meets every year in mid-New Jersey. over Thanksgiving weekend. So I got an invitation to the mail that we're going to have all the Rabbanim are invited on Friday morning to come to a shiur on end-of-life issues. So I figured I took off that weekend. So anyways, I was in Teaneck. I figured I didn't like to do anyways. So I figured I'd drive down to East Brunswick. I go to the Yehuda convention. I had never been there before. So I was in the room. I was in a room with about 80 rabbis. I did not, the only one that I knew. I knew one rabbi in the room of about 80. Right? Who was the one that I knew? So Shmuel Kamenetsky was there. He was the only one that I knew. So it's the only one that knew me. Okay, so it was about the issue of end-of-life issues. And Rabbi Viner, who runs a kollel in Eretz Yisrael, dealing with these issues, introduced with the following line, which is a good interesting introduction. So the pasuk tells us at the end of, in the beginning of Perek Tes of Sefer Bereishis. That's the end of Parshas Noach. Not really the end of Parshas Noach, but kind of the middle of Parshas Noach. But it's after Noach comes out of the Teva. So Noach is out of the Teva. He's now going to replenish. He's going to rebuild the world. And Kadosh Baruch Hu tells him, Noach, because you were moser nefesh so much, because you saved the lives of all these animals, you will always have. You'll have bilus over them. You will have authority over them. And therefore, you're entitled to eat meat. Right? That's the heter for eating meat. So then the pasuk comes along and says, however, v'yachas damchem l'nafsha seichem edrosh miyad kolchaya adar shanu. He says, however, the blood of yourself I will analyze. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, you will be held responsible for your own blood. Right? So this means you're not allowed to commit suicide. You're responsible for your own blood. Umiyad ha'adam, and from the responsibility of other people, meaning if you murder other people, miyad ishachiv, from a man who's your brother. Ed Rosh Has Nefesh Adam. I'm going to hold you responsible for the Nefesh Adam. So, asks all the Mefarshim, what's the repetition here? Miyad Ha'adam, Umiyad Ishachi, from the hands of a person and from the hands of your brother. Right? But that's the same thing, right? You're not allowed to murder anybody. Right? So, how do you understand these two? What are these two words having to do with each? How do you understand this phrase? So, the Sefer Ksav HaKabbalah, Rav Mecklenburg, who lived, I think, in the mid 1800s, I forget now. In that year, he actually wrote his parish, Ksava HaKabbalah. He wrote the parish as a way of showing how the Torah, especially if you understand Pshat in the Torah, could really take on the maskilim, to take on those people that are giving other interpretations of the Torah, etc. So he says as follows, why did the Torah mention both Adam and Ish? Furthermore, why is the word Achiv added to the word Ish? So I believe the reason is that there are two kinds of murder. Number one, the desire to punish the murdered person because one wants to take revenge for something he did to the murderer, or the desire to rob him of money, meaning a person will murder in order to, like we're used to on TV shows, right? The person in order to rob him or in order to whatever reason he is. And number two, the reason is the desire to do the murdered person a favor by killing him, such as a terminally sick person who suffers great pain, which the killer wants to spare him. We have, and he quotes two examples of this. Number one is that of Avimelech, who is a story in Shoftim, who was the son of Gideon and was attacking and then had something thrown in his head and was about to die, and in order to alleviate pain he had somebody go ahead and kill him. And the more famous one is that Shaul HaMelech, at least David was told that the way Shaul HaMelech died was that this guy, the Amalek, this Amalek kid killed Shaul. He took out his sword and killed Shaul because Shaul had asked him. That's not necessarily what happened, right? There's two different versions. The Navi says, and then what this Isha Maliki tells David actually how, right? So it's a little unclear what exactly happened there, but what he told David was that Shaul was writhing in pain, right? And I killed him in order to help him out. So the Navi refers to that as murder, right? And that's also murder. And therefore he goes on and says on top of the second column, these two instances, the killer actually had the best interest of the murdered person at heart. When our verse speaks about Adam, it refers to someone whose motive is for killing is to harm the victim, right? It says, Adam, you're responsible for all the Adam you killed. When the Torah mentions afterwards, ish achiv, so it refers to mercy killing, hence the additional achiv, someone whom one considered as one's brother. I mean, if you kill them because he's your brother, still that's considered murder, still that's considered something that is prohibited. And that is that's the challenge here, right? We have, so on one hand, we want to say, no matter what happens, no matter what conclusion we come to, right, we're going to keep the person alive at all costs. Right? The person has to stay alive because we're going to, and even if there's no chance, and even if this, and even if that, right, and even if the person is a lot of pain, right, we're going to keep that person alive no matter what. Right, so that's one side, right, and that's in a way what this is supporting, right? If he's almost being he's giving a prophecy here. It's going to come a time when, right, and that would be what one would get from this side. However, we know that there are certainly values on the other side. The values on the other side are really two. Number one is there is the idea here of not causing a person unnecessary pain. In the two examples that the Ksav HaKabbalah quoted, right, what happened there? Right, the person was in pain, the person was dying, and he said, "You kill me," right? You murder me, you kill me, right? And that, the Ksav Kabbalah says, is not allowed. But what might be allowed, what might be allowed, is not to do anything, right? That might be, right? I'm not going to, I'll let you die, I'm not going to continue. That's one idea, that in order to, you know, to save the person additional pain, so it might be that one doesn't have to continually aggressively treat the person. That's number one. The second thing, which is why this has become so important in the last couple of years, and way why it's become a little controversial in the last couple of months, is because of the whole issue of organ donations. That there are certain organs that the only way, that not necessarily the only way, but the popular way of acquiring those organs is that if a person is brain dead, so in a way their bodies are still working, their bodies are still functioning, their organs are still functioning, just in a way the person's dead, or at least the claim is that the person is dead. So that's an ideal time to harvest their organs. That's an ideal time to be able to, you know, to take the organs, that you'll be able to save the life of another person. So that's a very altruistic thing. That's a very important thing to be able to do. So, and any way that we could facilitate such a thing, we'd obviously be in favor of doing. Right? The only thing we're not necessarily going to be in favor of doing is murder, right? Right. So depending on which way, if you're going to be, so this is a classic case of every stringency is really a leniency. Shefty used to point out to us that every stringency is really a leniency, no matter where. Any stringency in all of halacha that you're going to find is always going to be a leniency in something else, right? What did he mean by that? We've spoken about this before. What does he mean by that? That any stringency in any area of halacha is going to be a leniency involved with it as well. All right. So a classic example would be in the area of taras hamishpacha. Right. So if a person's going to be extra strict in taras hamishpacha and make whatever it is, a woman's never going to be able to go to the mikvah. Right. So she's being very strict in taras hamishpacha, but she's being very lenient in what? She's being very lenient in the mitzvah of pruervu, or the mitzvah of having children, and she's being very lenient in the mitzvah of shalom bayis, right? It's going to cause other problems. So very nice, you want to be strict in one area, but realize you're going to be lenient in another area, right? You're going to be very strict in the laws of Eiruvin, right, such that it's going to be impossible to build an Eiruv anywhere, right? So it's very nice, you want to be strict in Hilchos Shabbos, but what are you being very lenient in? Right? You're being very lenient in the mitzvah of?
Guests
of Oneg Shabbos, right? You might be very strict in Shmir Shabbos, but you're being very lenient in the midst of Oneg Shabbos, right? So there's always a balance. Anytime one picks on a stringency, so you have to realize what the balance here. So here it's very clear what the balance is, right? If I want to be very strict in order to keep a person alive, right? So I'm being very lenient in organ donations and the pain that I might be giving that person. If I'm going to be very strict and say, no, you have to give organs at any cost, we're going to go, right? So you're being very lenient in a pretty important mitzvah as well. What's that?
Murder,
right? So the stakes are very high. Stakes, S-T-A-K-E-S, right? The stakes are very high when it comes to the issue of brainness. So I put down that this is going to be a 2-week thing. To really go through the material well would take a year and a half. I mean, it's a very serious thing with a lot of material, much of which has been written in the previous 20, 30 years for obvious reasons, 40 years for obvious reasons. But what I wanted to do tonight is really set the groundwork for next Wednesday night. Okay, tonight I want to, I put down four, or two, three, four, and five on the sheet. So these are four primary sources that are found. I made a extra effort not to include anything post 1200 or so. There's a rush, so 1320 or so. Okay, nothing past that time. I really want to just go to the original sources, see what we're dealing with, and see what was used, what is being used really by the modern day poskim to analyze this question. So again, the halacha is as we see here. The halacha is real, and the halacha is eternal, and the halacha is a Torah's Chaim. The halacha will deal with this. We hope, at least. We think that it will, we're just not sure necessarily how, right? So that's what I want to focus on. What is the halacha in theory, and then how that plays out in terms of the modern day questions, modern day answers that have been given, that we'll get to B'ezras Hashem next week, okay? So I prefer also that all questions about modern day things, that also we save that till next week. This week is really to understand what the background is, the way they would deal with brain death in the 600s or so. Wasn't really that big of an issue, which is why there aren't that many sources to cover tonight. Okay, so the most famous source on the topic is the Gemara in Maseches Yuma, at the very end of Maseches Yuma. So what does it say over there? So it says, Tanu Rabbanan, it was taught, Ad Heichan Hu Bodek. So until what would they would check? Now what's it talking about checking? So the Gemara there is talking about if you have a pile of building collapses, and you know that there are people inside, right? So people inside, so you know, pikuach nefesh, and it's Shabbos, right? So pikuach nefesh. So I'm going to dig through the rubble in order to find this person. Why do I want to find this person? So I want to save his life, right? I want to save his life. It's a very important mitzvah. So, however, what am I violating in order to save his life? Remember, it's Shabbos. What?
You're separating.
Not really separate. I want to show you go separating, but you're muksa. You're violating muksa. You're violating muksa. Whatever it is muksa. Okay. So the Gemara wants to know. So we're going to dig. We're going to violate the halachas of muksa at least. There might be other halachas as well, but we're at least going to violate the halachas of muksa in order to perhaps save this person's life. So the Gemara wants to know, let's say I find him, right? And I find him, and he looks kind of dead. Not just kind of dead, he looks really dead. And the question is, do I continue to violate Shabbos if it seems like this person is dead? So how do I check if the person is alive or not? So the Gemara says, Ad heichan hu bodek, ad chotmo. You check until his nose. What does it mean you check his nose? Right? Not to see if his nose is bloody, but you check to see if he's breathing. Right? V'yishomrim ad libo, that you check until his heart. You check the heart. You check and you see that the upper bodies, I mean, there might be a lot of bodies in this collapsed building. The upper bodies are dead, right? Don't say, oh, the bottom ones are for sure dead also. You don't have to say that. Rather, you should continue digging. And the work continues with a couple other details of continuing to check. However, Amar Rav Papa, however, says, Machlokes mimata lamala. The machlokes above. Well, we'll see how Rashi interprets this. The dispute that was referred to of where do you check till the chotbo or till the libo, or till the heart, right, is only when going from bottom to top. About mimala lamata, but if you're going from top to bottom, I mean, the first thing that you uncover is the nose, right? Kevan debadok le'ad chotmo, shuvei notzarech. Once you've checked until the nose, you don't have to go dig anymore. Right, the Ksiv Kolash and Nishmas Ruach Chayim Biapo, as the Pasuk tells us, all the spirit of the Neshama is found in their mouth. It's found in their nose, it's found in their breathing. Right? So what that's very important. That's just told us the whole thing, right? We should just end the shiur, right? Right? If a person is breathing, right, then they are alive. If the person is not breathing, then they are dead. Right? That seems to be what we're coming what this Gemara is coming to teach us. So let's continue to develop this a little bit. So Rashi comes and tells us, Rashi here, Hachi Garsinan, Amar Rav Papa Machlokes Milmata Lamala, the dispute is if you're going from bottom to top. What does it mean the Machlokes is going if the dispute is if you're going from bottom to top? Meaning if you're going from bottom to top, do you have to go all the way to the nose? Or if you see that the heart isn't, we'll say, operating for now, if you see that the heart isn't operating, so perhaps you could stop right there. So the Gemara says, So Rashi explains, again, this is the second from bottom source, Machlokas Tahanach Tanai, the Machlokas of these Tanayim, right, the Amar Mar Ad Libo, Amar Mar Ad Chotmo, Rel Mata Lemala Shemotsu Derach Margolosav Techila. It's going to be going from the bottom to the top, because he started from the Margolosav. The Margolosav are the, help me out here. What? What do you say? No?
Legs.
The legs, right? You start from the legs and gone up, right? Ubodik v'holei kalpi rosho, and you're checking up towards the head. Demar amar b'libo yesh lahavchin im yesh bochius. That one says, by way of the heart, you could tell if there is life. Shenishmaso dofekes sham, because the neshama resides there. The neshama, the life is living there. Umar amar no ad chotmo. You have to go up to the nose. Why? The zimnin de ein chayos nicker belibo ve nicker bechotmo. That perhaps the life is not recognizable in the heart, but is recognizable in the nose. Okay. So the important part of this Rashi is what? Can anybody bring something out from this Rashi? Yeah.
Well, that even if the heart is not beating, that's not sufficient to declare the person dead.
Right. Well, if the heart, it's not, again, it's not.
If you can't tell, then you can't assume that that defines death.
Right. But not breathing does define death. That's what it sounds like. However, Rashi's saying a little bit more. Rashi's saying, not necessarily, it's not that breath is defining. It's not that if a person is breathing, then they are alive. Rashi really is saying here is that what is the best indication about whether a person is alive or not? Right? So their breath. I mean, if the person is not breathing, chances are they really are dead. Right? Chances are they're really dead, and that I'm not going to violate Shabbos anymore on their behalf. Right? There's a difference here. It's not that breathing defines life, necessarily. Maybe it does. But it's not that breathing defines life. You don't have to read it that way. Rather, breathing tells you that the person is alive. So if we could figure out other ways that the person might be alive without the person necessarily breathing. Oh, perfect. Perfect switch. On the fly. Right? If you could tell, if somehow the person might be alive without the idea that they're breathing, right? So then what? Would the person be alive? It sounds like yes, right? It sounds like that the person would in fact be alive.
Given the technology available at the time for most people's abilities, unless they're like Rambam, I mean, it would probably be easier for like the average person to see whether they're breathing rather than to pick up a heartbeat, especially if it's slowed down and it's weak.
Right. No, that's what the Gemara for sure is saying. That the Gemara for sure is saying that it's easier to pick up a breath than it is a heart. Right, you put a feather. There's tests that you can do that will decipher that. And right, and it could be that they never, you don't want to say they never imagined, but you could say that it wasn't in their calculation a concept that a person might have other bodily functions going without the ability to breathe. So what is that a description of then? Right, so that might be a description of a person is what we call today, for lack of a better terminology right now, brain dead. Right, so what happens if a person is brain dead? So what happens is that their breathing function is not being maintained. There's no message going down to their lungs to continue to expand and retract and to transfer the oxygen, the CO2, and to keep that thing going. Right, there's no message going there to do it. Right, so how is that how is that being done? Right, so that's being done by way of the ventilator. That's being done by way of this artificially. It's breathing back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. It's artificially. So if you would take the machine off, right? So then it would stop, right? That's the theory. The theory is it would stop. However, there is something else that is going on in the body that might also be defining it as being alive, which is what? that the blood is going to continue to flow, that the heart is going to continue to beat, and the blood is going to continue to flow. So it could be that if the heart is beating and the blood is flowing, right, the person might be considered alive, regardless of the fact that the person is breathing or not. Okay, so that. So what do we see from this Rashi now? So this Rashi might have first thought, you may first at first glance at this Gemara say that the person can breathe, they're alive, the person can't breathe, they're not alive. Says Rashi, you could make out from this Rashi that that's not necessarily the case, right? It could be that that's just a good indicator. I mean, one isn't Mechal Shabbos for a 1 in 3 million chance that you might say, well, I shouldn't say that. But if you know, a little hard to decipher that. If there's a 1 in a several million chance that there would be a life to even save, let's put it like that.
Well, let's put it this way. Just a big earthquake in New Zealand. What if it happened on Shabbos?
Right.
And there was a building that collapsed, and unfortunately, people did die. But
right.
If it happened on Shabbos.
Right, so there the assumption would be that the person would be considered, you'd assume that the person would be alive. Right? And the truth is, you continue to say, even if there's a chance that they're alive. So says the Rashi that if the person is not breathing, chances are that they're that's a strong enough chance that they're dead, that at that point we're going to stop trying to save them. We're going to stop violating the Shabbos in an effort to save them. Okay, that's what we would decipher from here. Okay, this rush, we don't necessarily need the rush. Anyway, so while this Gemara at first glance might have told us a lot about how we define death, and after Rashi gets done with it, pretty much tells us nothing. Right? Pretty much tells us what would be an indication of whether the person is alive or not. But if we have a way of deciphering that they are alive without that indication, right, the indication isn't going to be very meaningful to us, right? Okay? All right. So let's go on to the second major source that's talked about in this with this. Any questions so far? Good? Okay. So the second thing we want to make reference to here is there's a famous Mishnah in Olos, which is also quoted in the Gemara at the beginning of the book. And it says like this. Adam eino mitame ashetetze nafsho. That a person doesn't cause tumah, a person doesn't cause impurity until they're dead. Right? And that sounds like a pretty good, healthy equation for us to go by. A person's dead, they become tame. While they're alive, they're not tame. Okay. However, it says, and there's a couple of words that I left out. I thought I would need more space. Okay. The chain behema v'chaya, so to animals. Einan mitamin achetesi nafshim. Right? So to animals, they don't die until they're dead. Right? They're not mitame until they're dead. Animals also, a nevela also could be mitame for certain things, right? Could actually cause tuma as well. Not the same way that men could, and Kohanim are allowed to be in contact with them, but whatever. There's also tuma that applies to animals as well. Okay. However, comes the Mishnah and says, Hutsu Roshehem, let's say you cut off their heads. Even though they're shaken around, they are already considered dead. They're already considered dead. What's the English word for the shaken around?
Convulsion.
Convulsion. They have this. There's a medical term for it. No. All right. Even though that they're still moving. Okay.
It's like sympathetic discharge.
Okay. Okay, so far it's Temeim. Kagon, right, they're still, they're Temeim. What does it mean that they're Temeim? It means that they're dead, right? So it means that this animal that's running around without a head on, right, you don't say that it's alive and just doesn't have a head, right? The Mishnah is telling us that it's dead. End of story, right? Kagon Zenav Shel Lita Shehime Farkesas. Like, for example, if you cut off the tail of a lizard, so the tail continues to also dance around, right? And no one's going to tell you that the tail is a separate lizard that happens to have a mind of its own right now, right? It's dead. It just happens to be moving. Right? So that's a good Mishnah. And again, with this Mishnah, at first glance, right, that seems to be telling us a very important thing about what we would call modern-day brain death, right? That is telling us that if the head is off, right, so it could be, what does it mean the head is off? If the head is off, even if the rest of the body continues to be moving and continues to be functioning, right, we're going to consider that person to be we're going to consider that person to be dead. There's a famous experiment that was done for Shlomo Zalman. I meant to check. I think it might actually be on YouTube, if you want the luck. In the early 90s, that while Shlomo Zalman Auerbach was studying this question, so in order to show him that the body could function without a head, so they took a pregnant sheep, right, and they hooked it up to a respirator. And they cut off the sheep's head, and they did it twice. One of the times the sheep actually gave birth to a baby sheep a couple hours later. Right? So what does that show? It shows that no one in the right mind. No one in their right mind is going to say that that a person could possibly be alive without their head attached to their body, right? No one would claim that. But yet you see that the body is functioning without that attachment. That was the meaning of that experiment. So that's what this Mishnah is saying. This Mishnah is saying that if the head is off, even though the body might be moving around, right? So therefore, the animal/the person are already considered dead, are already mitame at that point, etc.
Excuse me,
can you go back a moment?
Are you referring to rigor mortis, or are you speaking of that there's another function prior to rigor mortis that would be functioning at that point in time?
I'm not sure. Rigor mortis comes
later.
Something else. That's when it becomes solid.
Yeah.
That's when it becomes stiff,
right?
So before that, with I'm not sure with people it's as evident, but when you shaft the chicken's run around, etc. Right?
Cool. He'll make death throes.
Okay.
THROES.
So that's often used to refer to at the end. So the throes of death is usually before. All right. So.
I've killed enough animals that there's a sympathetic discharge in this movement.
Right. Right. I've become faint at enough shchitas that I've seen the same.
Before you became faint.
Yes, yeah, so I realized that in high school, a little older, a friend of mine they actually had a shchita class in the fourth floor MTA bio lab. Anybody familiar with the MTA building? So it's used for other things as well. Right, they would have shchita classes there. And so a friend of mine took them, and when he did his first chicken, he invited me, and didn't go well. Okay. So the Rambam writes. So the Rambam wrote several very important things, right? So one of we usually quote the Rambam in his Yad HaZaka, in his Mishnah Torah, in the Book of Halachos. We also very often quote the Rambam in his Mora Nevuchim, his Guide to the Perplexed. So the third major work of the Rambam, there are many others, was his Perush HaMishnayos. I think he wrote when he was the youngest. The first thing that he wrote was the Perush HaMishnayos. I believe he wrote in Arabic. And it was translated. It was translated over. So whenever you read the Perush HaMishnayos, there's always going to be different translations. Right? There's different editions, different translations. So anyway, not that important right now. So the Rambam writes in his in the explanation of that Mishnah, he writes V'yera zel miksas mine bali chayim im lo haya hakoach hamania mispashe b'chol haivarim. Miyasod umotzi echad el yim mefulag b'chol haguf. So what is he saying here? We see this happened with certain bali chayim, with certain animals. That im lo haya hakoach hamania, that if the koach hamania, what's the koach hamania? The strength of motion, meaning the thing that is causing it to move, mispashet b'chol ha'ivarim, that's throughout all of its limbs, miyasod, comes from one place, umotzeyacha, from one place, el yim mifulag b'chol haguf, but rather spread out throughout the entire body. All right, so what's the Rambam saying here? The Rambam is saying here that why is it that the pirkus, that the motion, the movement of these animals, that after they die, why is it that they're moving? Is it because they have a central thing that's a concentrated movement that we're going to move a leg and another leg? Right, it's not concentrated movement. It's that each individual limb is making decisions for itself. Right? It's not like it's a conscious thing. It's whatever. That there's a limb moving one way, a limb moving the other way. That's the way it's working. So Rambam is saying that why is it that the movement does not count as the animal being alive? Because the information, the cause of that movement, is not coming from a force of life. Rather, it's coming from each individual limb. So what does this Rambam teach us? Right, what's the flip side then? But if it was coming from one place that was causing it, at least a life force that was causing it, so perhaps then one would say that it would still be considered alive. Maybe that's one thought that's thrown out. I think you could.
But the fact that the observation is the reverse suggests that this particular situation is not indicating that the
right
animal.
Right, that could be. Right,
it's not an indication that the animal is alive.
Right, however, if it would be together, right, if it would be coming from one place, right, then maybe one would make sense. Right, this case is not happening, right? It's defining Pyrrhicus. When you go and the chicken's running around, right, it's not, there's no lower brain to the chicken telling it to move, right? But if maybe there would be some central thing telling it to move, so then maybe it would be different. So the Tosfos Rid, one of the Bali Tosfos, makes the following observation as well, another very important observation on this. He says that how long do these Pyrrhicus last already? Right? These Pyrrhicus, he's not really making this observation, we make it with the Tosfos Rid. How long do these Pyrrhicus last? A minute at most, 2 minutes, right? How long would could a person, what we're talking about, in terms of a person being brain dead on a ventilator, how long are they going to last? Right, they're going to last a lot longer than that. Right, they could last weeks, months, years. Right, they can last for a very long time. So Tosfos Rid already is pointing out, not dealing with ventilators, but dealing with something else that looks to us like it's alive, but is in actuality dead. And this takes a little bit of an imagination, or at least, not really an imagination, but at least some open-mindedness, that there was this assumption in medicine in the time of the Gemara, that children were born either after 7 months or after 9 months. That good, healthy children were either 7 months or 9 months. Right? If it was born in the 8th month, it's as good as dead. Right? The Gemara then turns around and says, well, we see all the time that there are children that are actually born in the 8th month since conception, and they seem to be, I'm one of them, and they seem to be alive. So the answer to that is, no, that was really a 9-monther that came out early. Or that was really a 7-month that came out later, right? So that you could they get around it. But the Gemara, in theory, if we could ascertain for sure that this baby was an 8-monther, however one could possibly ascertain it, so one would not be allowed to violate Shabbos on its behalf. One would not be allowed to. There's a couple. This is why it's found in the Gemara and Shabbos. One would not have their bris on the 8th day for that reason, because it's not considered a living. Now it looks like it's alive. It feels like it's alive. Certainly crying like it's alive, right? But it wouldn't necessarily be considered fully alive. So Tosfos Rid makes a comment about Pyrrhicus de Ben Shmona, the movement of a Ben Shmona, meaning that's 3 weeks old and it's still alive, right? The Pyrrhicus of an 8th day. Because it's able to live till 29 days, you're not going to consider it dead in that case, right? Even though we're going to call that Pyrrhicus, because it's a quote-unquote dead baby, right? We're going to call it Pyrrhicus, we're going to call it movement, it's not really going to consider movement because it could last for a very long time, right? So that's another thing to pull in here. Wait a second, if it could last for a very long time, who says that Mishnah Olos is applicable at all to our situation anymore, right? So those are really the two major sources that are brought up. The Mishnah, again, the Gemara in Yuma and the Gemara in Olos, that are very applicable or seem to be talking about brain death, and as we've seen, they're both pretty inconclusive. Right, one more hole to make in this is that the Rambam in Hilchos Shechita, when he quotes this din about when an animal is still meaningful, what if an animal is not dead yet? What can you do to an animal? in theory, although it's probably going to be treif at that point, right? You could shacht it, right? If it's alive, it's alive, right? So the Rambam writes here, the nishbra mifrekes rov basarima, if the neck is broken off and most of the meat is with it, o shenikra migava kedago shenifsak rov akana, or the back of it is torn and the kana is torn, o shenikiv haveshet, or the windpipe, the food pipe is torn and the windpipe is cut, haroy l'shi, the hareze nevela michayim. It is like a living nevela. What does that mean? Right? But the Rambam, living nevela means an animal that died, a dead animal that wasn't shechted. That's what we call a nevela. So it's a living nevela. What is that? Right? So we don't know. And that just adds to this to the confusion here. Okay, so those are the two. Again, those are the two that life has to do with breathing. Major sources. The other side, yeah. Any questions? Good. So the other side of this big debate. I'll just quote two more major sources that demonstrate the other side that says that no, it doesn't have to do with breathing. Rather, life is really defined by the circulation of the blood. That's 100%, you know, 100% or possibly how you define death. So those sources, there are several sources that indicate that. I'll just throw out a few of them. One is im b'machteras yimatzi aganav fi ka umeis ein lo damim. That there is a very important halacha. I don't know how far, but if somebody is tunneling and digging into your house, right? So the halacha is the pasuk in Chumash that we read a couple to 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, is that you're allowed to kill him. Right? If someone's tunneling into your house, you're allowed to you shoot and ask questions later. That was our motto in Arizona. Okay? Shoot and ask questions later. So that's a pasuk, right? Right, a person is tunneling in, right? So why is it that you're allowed to kill him? So the pasuk tells us why. Ein lo damim. It's like he doesn't have blood, which is interpreted to mean he's not alive. It's as if he's not alive at that point. He's not worthy of life, right? So you can point out from there. So you see that there is that life is really defined by the blood rather than by the air that they're breathing. I mean, yes, it's true. You'll figure out if they're alive based on whether they're breathing, but the real source of life is the circulation of blood.
Doesn't God say that in the Torah? Don't eat the blood of an animal because the blood is its life.
That's another source. Right, I just put things. I want to make the Arizona joke, so it's in the next source. What? I put that in here? Oh, right. That pasuk made it in here also. Okay, fine. The pasuk made it in here because Rabbeinu Tam quotes that the Gemara in the beginning of Ksuvus, of all places, so discusses what's the prohibition of causing somebody to bleed. So on Shabbos, is there a problem with it if you cause somebody to bleed on Shabbos? So they line up. This Tosfos is a long Tosfos along the side of the daf, and all the it quotes different opinions about what's the problem causing a person to bleed. So one of those opinions is Rabbeinu Tam, right? V'nira l'Rabbeinu Tam l'faresh dehotzaas dam chashiva netilas neshama, that taking out blood is like netilas neshama, is like killing. Right, so you could say that drawing blood on Shabbos is an issur of dash, and that you're drawing blood. You could say that it's an issur of shchita, that you're squeezing out liquid from a salad. Or you could say it's an issur of shchita, it's an issur of killing. Right, you're not allowed to kill just because you're not killing the person. Right, you're killing a small part of them. You're causing blood to come out, and that's a demonstration of death. Right, and he concludes by saying the tilas sham ki adam hu nefesh, because dam is nefesh, v'chishen notel miksaso notel miksas neshama, and when you take a little bit of the blood, you're taking a little bit of the neshama. So that's side number one. And the second source is an interesting mishnah in Erchin. There is a mishnah in Erchin. What is Erchin? Or Arachin? What are Arachin? What is this? I'm like dreading getting up to this in Daf Yomi.
How much you're worth.
Right. A person decides to spot. Erech is an estimation. So if I say, I'm going to give, I like Norm so much, I'm going to give Norm's value to the Beis HaMikdash. Right? As a birthday present. Right? That'll be or we're all going to chip in together in order to give Norm's value to the Beis HaMikdash as a birthday present for him. Right? So that's, so we figure out, so there's a whole Masechta, not a whole Masechta dealing specifically with that, there's a whole Masechta dealing with how do you evaluate things in terms of their value, because the Beis HaMikdash IRS is going to be coming after you in order to make sure that they get every penny. So the Mishnah tells us that you can only do erchin for an entire person. Right, you can't give erchin of your arm, you can't give erchin of your toe, you can't give erchin of your shoulder, right? It doesn't work, right? It's all or nothing in terms of the value of a person. But the Mishnah does make the following point. It says, erech roshi, ve'erech kvedi alai, no saint erech kula. If a person says, the worth of my head, or the worth of my liver, right? The worth of my liver, that works. Zehakla, and you have, not only does it work, but you have to give your entire worth, your entire value has to be given to the base of mission. That's the case, and it concludes the haklal davish haneshama tuluya bo nosin erech kulo. If something that the neshama is reliant upon, so then you have to give the entire value of a person. So the Rambam A in the Perusha Mishnah is there, and then B in his Yad Chazak in the Mishnah Torah in his Book of Halachos quotes this halacha, and he tells you what those mysterious organs are that the quote unquote neshama to Luyavo. And what are they? Haomer Dmei Roshi O Kvedi Alai O Dmei Roshi Shel Ploni Alai, right? Either my head or my liver or his head, right? O Libo or his heart or Kvedo or his liver. A lie is my responsibility. No sin to make kulan. You got to give his whole value. V'chein omer to make chatzi a lie. The half of it is upon me. No sin to make kulan. You have to give the value of all of it. Aval haomer chatzi to make a lie. My money, right? No sin chatzi dumb. So then you give money. I'm not sure why that is. We have to learn Hilchos Erchin. I'm not sure. But what did the Rambam do here? The Rambam spelled out three organs that the neshama is tuluya about. What are those three? Right? The head, the heart, and the liver. So now the question comes up. Okay, tell me something, Maimonides. You left out a detail. What does that mean? Is it all three that the neshama is tuluya bo? Let's say you got two out of three. Could you still be alive?
Or only one of the three.
Or one of the three, can you still be alive? Or do you need all three? As soon as one is gone, so then you're considered as if it's as if it's over. So the
and by the way, none of this has to do with breath or stuff that we talked about earlier.
Well, it has to do with the important organs of the body.
Okay, but we're clearly all right.
So
why didn't he say lungs? Lungs are an organ too. I mean.
Well, yeah.
Mm.
He didn't.
He didn't, but that would take care of
breath,
wouldn't it?
A person live without organs? Without lungs?
Doubtful.
No, you can't.
How else are you going to?
Not well.
Not long. You can't live long. There's a lot of organs you can't live
long. Yeah, kidneys.
The time. The question is how long.
Yeah,
every organ you're going to be. We're not going there.
You could probably survive without a liver for a little while. You might be able to survive without lungs for a little while also.
Not really.
You have a respirator, etc. Well, actually, it's so in the, we're not going there. Okay. So the.
All guys have to kidney, sure. They don't have a liver.
We're not going there either. So, all right. So one of the proofs to this comes from the Sefer Mishkanes Yaakov, which is quoted from a Mishnah in the beginning of Avodah Zarah. He says that the following things, Elu Dvarim Sh'olot Kachavim Asurim V'Yisurim Isur Hana, that if these things that belong to an non-Jew, right, so those things are prohibited, right, because they probably use it for Avodah Zarah. Number one is their wine. Number two is their Chomei Sho Avodah Chom Sh'ayim Mechilasu Yayin, meaning their vinegar, right, the wine turned into vinegar, right. The Cheres HaDinairi, that certain types of pottery, because they use those for Avodah Zarah as well, the oros levuvin, and the skin of hearts. What is that? What is the skin of hearts? So the Gemara Rashi and the Gemara teach tell us that that what happened was is that these are talking about the skins of the animals, that part of the avoda that the non-Jews used to do was that they would take the hearts out while the animal was still alive. Right, so because the avoda was done in that particular way, right? So the whole animal is considered no good, not usable anymore. So the only problem with that is that Yerushalmi asks, why should those animals be usser? Why should the animals be prohibited? The Yerushalmi says, it's still alive. right? And we know that you can't impose an Isser Hana, you can't impose a prohibition of benefit on an animal that is still alive. And the Yerushalmi goes and gives an answer to that. And it says, oh, no, this case is different, etc. But what does that seem to be indicating, though? It seems, from based on the question of the Yerushalmi, that you could take the heart out of an animal, right, and the animal is still going to be considered alive. You say, impossible. It could be considered alive for at least a little bit.
Not very long.
All right, maybe not for very long. But what do you see? You see that the Yerushalmi is considering that being alive. Considering that being like possibly, now, but not so, you don't necessarily have to hold like that. You're not bound to that interpretation, but perhaps that might be an indication the other way, right? That it's not the dam that's necessarily required, that if the animal's still breathing, so that might be the requirement. Okay, so at the end, so we really have just raised a whole bunch of issues here, right? At least we've gotten used to the language of what kind of clues are we looking for in the Gemara and in the Rishonim to try to, you know, can we use something that's reusable to prove a point one way or the other. Next week we'll see, Lemaisa, how some of these are. Okay.